Hey, listeners. Happy November. It's your host, Daisha. Since it's November, that means two things. Boktoberfest is over, and it's decorative gourd season.
Decorative gourd season.
In this episode of Classical Classroom, you're about to learn about a composer named Menotti, and not one, but two operas that he wrote. And in fact, if you're in the Houston area, you can actually go out and catch Opera in the Heights, production of these two operas that's happening right now. Go to their website, operaintheheights.org, to find out more information about that. If you're not in the Houston area, it's okay. You can still subscribe to us on iTunes. And you know what? Because it's November, the month of Thanksgiving here in the United States, I'm not going to ask you guys to rate and review us. Instead, I'm going to thank all of those wonderful listeners out there who have already rated and reviewed us on iTunes. And I'm going to thank all of you in advance who are, you know, you're about to rate and review us for all of the nice things that you are inevitably going to say. Thank you. Here's the show. Enjoy. Let's eat. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz, but when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Linda McKnight. Linda is a faculty member at the University of Houston's Moore School of Music. That's right, she is actually Dr. McKnight. She directs operas regularly at the Moore's Opera House over there. She's a soprano who made her debut with the Metropolitan Opera in 1991. She's also a recording and touring artist. But most importantly for our purposes today, she's an advisory board member and a stage director at Houston's Opera in the Heights. And Linda, what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, we're going to be talking about the operas, the medium and the telephone. And they're a little bit off the beaten path. So we're going to talk about the composer of the two operas we'll be doing, our Halloween offerings.
Okay, so this is Opera in the Heights, Halloween opera production, essentially. Okay, that's what I thought. I didn't read too much because I wanted for you to teach me about it, but it sounded like these operas were potentially creepy.
A little bit. The first one especially.
Yeah.
The first one is a ghost story, basically.
Okay.
And it's a piece I've loved for years and always wanted to do on a Halloween weekend. And I finally am getting the chance to do that.
Well, before we get into that, and I'm super curious about it, but first let's talk a little bit about the composer. What's his name? Who was he?
His name is Giancarlo Menotti.
Uh-huh.
And with a name like that, you'd kind of expect him to be writing big, fancy Italian operas.
Uh-huh.
But he actually considered himself and described himself as an American opera composer. He was born in Italy, but he moved to the States when he was 14 and lived in Philly. He attended the Curtis Institute, which is a very prestigious music school on the East Coast.
I've even heard of it. So,
yes, it's a great school, and he went there. It's particularly known for composition. A lot of really significant American composers have come out of that program.
Okay.
If you've ever heard the Barber Adagio for Strings, for instance, the theme from Platoon, the movie Platoon, it's done a lot as a concert piece and in movie scoring, and its composer also went to Curtis. There was a whole generation there of folks there that were really, really significant in 20th century music.
I see.
And Menotti was one of them. And he started as a student there and eventually became a faculty member where he taught composition as well. So he lived in the States almost all of his life.
Okay.
And so he really did. He said, I am an American. I am an American opera composer.
Okay. Hence the not fancy Italian operas.
Exactly. He did write three early works in Italian, but really all of the works that he wrote that are known today are in English.
Okay.
And not only did he write the music, he writes his own libretto.
Oh, I was going to ask, because I always forget that about opera, is that, you know, because I cover more classical music on this show, you know, you're usually just dealing with the one person. In opera, you're usually dealing with two. So you're saying he actually wrote the words, wrote the stories, and wrote the music.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Which is kind of unusual. Huh. It's become a little more common in the modern era, in the 20th and 21st centuries. But, you know, Mozart had a librettist that he used. Verdi had a librettist that he used. But Menotti, even though English wasn't his first language, he writes all of his own English libretti. And with very few exceptions, they're exceptionally well done and very poetic, beautiful language and use of the language. Every now and then you hear a little something that makes you say, maybe English wasn't his second language. There's a very small occurrence of that.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. So he's actually, I'm totally surprised to find out that he was an American. Who were his influences? Like, what do you hear in his music?
Well, you certainly hear the classic Italian tradition. You know, you hear Puccini, you know, one of the big guys in opera for us. And you hear that lush Italian lyricism that Puccini and Leoncavallo and all of those late romantic, early 20th century composers, their style. Yeah. You hear that in his music. But he was also very influenced by the music that he heard in America at the time, somewhat by jazz and popular music. Certainly you hear some of that in his idiom. He was also incredibly influenced by film scoring music. You know, the 40s, when he starts really getting going as a composer, are known for they're kind of the first generation where film scoring was a really important, almost a character in a lot of the movies of the time. And when you listen to many of his operas, it sounds kind of like a film score meets a Puccini opera.
Really?
In fact, that's how I would describe the medium, certainly.
Okay, well, now we've got to hear some music, but also just wanted to say that all of the Italian opera composers have the coolest names.
They do.
Of anybody in the classical world. So, okay, should we do the medium first?
Sure, let's listen to some medium.
Okay, well, first, tell me the plot, like the basic.
Okay. It's about, oddly enough, a medium. And it's about a woman named Madame Flora. She's also known as Baba to her daughter and her ward. But she is, she's a scam artist. She pretends to be a medium, and they have rigged up all of this paraphernalia to create seances for customers who pay to come and hear from their dear departed. And in the case of the seance that we actually see in the opera, it's the two families' dead children that come back and talk to them.
Okay.
And she takes the money then from them. And so she's very much a scam artist. And you know, there is a little bit of the whole crime doesn't pay theme in the show, but it's really deeper than that. She's this opera was written in 47 or premiered professionally in 1947, just after the war, and we don't really know much about Baba's past, but we would assume that she has had some contact with a concentration camp. Maybe she was interned in a concentration camp. Maybe she was witnessed the things that went on during the war. But she certainly has been influenced by that, and it's made her very much a survivor. And her philosophy is kind of do whatever it takes to survive, and that seems to be a common theme among people that survived the Holocaust.
I see. Well, okay. Now I think we should get into the actual music. Where should we start?
Well, you could begin in the seance that happens at the beginning of, or in the first act, the beginning of the opera. And we have three clients, Mr. and Mrs. Gobineau and Mrs. Nolan, and they've all come to hear from their children.
Okay.
And Mrs. Nolan has just lost her 16-year-old daughter about a year before, and she's very afraid of coming to a seance. She worries that this might be evil and wrong. And so almost immediately when she gets into the seance, she hears what she thinks is her daughter's voice. It's actually Baba's daughter, Monica, pretending to be this child. But and Monica sings a beautiful aria about how death is not such a horrible thing, that it's just a part of life. It's a really beautiful piece of music.
All right, let's hear some. Oh, so she's like actually comforting the woman.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the second act, when things fall apart and Baba confesses to these clients that it's a sham, I've cheated you.
Yeah.
They don't want to believe it. They say, no, 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 you haven't cheated us. No, please let us have our seance. Because this is all they have in their lives, is coming and talking with the people that they loved. And so even though she's scamming them, she's also giving them great comfort.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of black and white in this opera.
Interesting. She's telling her to give away all of her stuff.
Yeah, she's telling her, move on.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not there. I'm here, but that's okay. But eventually, she'll tell her, you know, give away my dresses, my necklace, my school books, my shoes. Mm-hmm. Keep for yourself only the little gold locket. And Mrs. Nolan says, what gold locket? I don't have a gold locket.
Uh-oh.
And all of a sudden, Doodly just kind of fades away, and we don't see her anymore.
Smooth.
But you can hear the lushness and the richness in this part of the score, how beautiful the music is.
Yeah.
Menotti's very good about writing music when something beautiful is being said, you know. I'm at peace. I'm happy. Let me rest. Mm-hmm. This is okay. The music is pretty. When there's something ugly being said or happening, the music will change drastically. He's very good at characterizing what's going on
the
stage
mood,
with the music he writes.
Huh.
And here you hear some of that film noir.
Yeah.
40s film noir.
Uh-huh.
The story goes on. What happens in the seance is that Madame Flora is pretending to be in a trance, and she feels an ice-cold hand on her throat.
Ooh.
And it completely unhinges her. She doesn't know what it is. You know, was it somebody at the seance that touched her? Was it a ghost? Was it her own? Was it a hallucination? She's an alcoholic, so it could, you know, and she's certainly been through trauma in her life mentally. And, you know, is it PTSD? Although they didn't have that term in 1947.
Right.
Is it something causing her to imagine this? And And she basically kind of starts a spiral descending into madness at that moment that continues because she cannot find out what it was.
Wow.
And she decides at first that it was Toby, who is the mute little boy that she has rescued during the Holocaust and who is her ward now. Mm-hmm. She's kind of adopted him. And he's now about 15, 16 years old, like her daughter Monica. And at first she blames him because it's somebody tangible that she can pin this on. You know, this was not a ghost. This was not a hallucination. It was a person. That's easy to accept. But it becomes clear that even with questioning that he didn't do it, and she keeps wanting to believe that. And it in the end, it drives her mad.
Oh, no.
And there's a very tragic ending to the story. So it's not a happy opera.
It doesn't sound like it.
It's very dark, but it's very powerful and gripping and engaging. Huh. So one of the big tunes from, probably the biggest tune from mm-hmm. the show, comes right at the beginning of the second act.
Okay.
Monica and Toby are home. Baba has been gone for several days out who knows where on a drinking binge, uh-huh. Trying to erase what happened from her mind. So Monica and Toby are in the house alone. And as they frequently do, they're often in the house. They don't go out much because Baba doesn't want the neighbors to know their children living there. They'd figure out how those seances happen.
Yeah.
So they're very isolated, and they're in the house playing. And Toby is doing a magic show for Monica to amuse her. And then she starts talking to him and pretending that she's living in the life that she hears on the radio that she listens to all the time. You know, that they've gone to a supper club and there's a show and dancing and supper. And Toby, she gets really caught up in this fantasy. And Toby is very frustrated because he wants to tell her he loves her, but he cannot speak. Mm-hmm. And so she ends up saying, "Toby, kneel down before me and tell me." And she sings the words she thinks he wants to say. Mm-hmm. And it's the hit tune from the show. It's a very poignant thing because she gets so wrapped up in her fantasy that she kind of loses sight of the fact that he's standing there and that he really loves her.
Okay.
And at the end, she makes it all right.
Okay.
For him. So this would be Monica's waltz.
Bravo! And off to the theater, supper and dance. Music! Up in the sky, someone is playing a trombone and a guitar. Red is your tie, and in your velveteen coat, you hide a star.
So she's singing what he would say.
Yeah, she will in a minute. This is her just in a fantasy land. We're in a fancy supper club like I hear on the radio, and we're going to go dancing, and you're going to be my partner.
Nice.
And you can hear that it's very clearly a waltz, mm-hmm. but there's also a little bit of discordant harmony in it, that things are not totally okay here.
Yeah.
And Monica herself is a strange girl, and she's lived a very odd life. And she's certainly been touched by that, too. There's a little bit of crazy in her also. Mm-hmm. You know, she's very much lives a life in her mind and in her fantasy world. Mm. And that's what she's doing here.
See.
And then she's all wrapped up in this, and she realizes Toby has turned away from her.
What is the matter, Toby? What is it you want to tell me?
That's such an interesting way of having this moment between two people.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's unusual. I don't know of anything else like it in opera. Yeah. I don't know of any other mute characters, really.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Significant mute characters.
Yeah.
But it's very touching. And that theme that you heard in the mm-hmm. strings, that's kind of Toby's theme. Like a lot of composers of the Italian, you know, this Italian tradition, Menotti finds themes that mean something and they come back over and over. And
leitmotif.
Yes, like a leitmotif, only Italian.
Only Italian.
but yeah, so we hear these motives and that's that Toby, da 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 da, that's Toby's theme.
Yeah, okay.
But also this Monica, the Monica theme that you're hearing right now, this comes back several times when something happens between the two of them, or especially when something happens to separate the two of them. Which makes it incredibly poignant. When Baba throws Toby out at the end, this is the theme that that we hear as Monica weeps.
Yeah.
Okay. So. It's interesting that the piece premiered professionally on Broadway, not in an opera house, in 1947.
Huh.
He had been commissioned to write the medium for Columbia University's opera program the year before, and they did it. So when they did the professional premiere, they decided it wasn't quite long enough for a Broadway show. It comes in at only 59 minutes, usually.
Okay.
So he wrote the telephone to go with it as a companion piece.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask how long this was.
Yeah,
I saw the
medium is
short.
59 minutes or so. Uh-huh. Telephone about 22, 23 minutes.
I see.
But almost immediately after its Broadway premiere, the medium was actually filmed in the style of a film noir movie.
Really?
With Anna Maria Alberghetti, who was a huge star of the 1950s, mm-hmm. as the title character.
Wow. So so tell us a little bit about the telephone. And you said that Menotti, he wrote this because essentially he needed to fill some time.
Yes.
Okay.
It was kind of filler.
I see.
And it is... It's a much different piece. It's very, it's fluffy, it's funny, it's lighthearted, and it's about a couple, and the man has decided to ask the girl, Ben has decided to ask Lucy to marry him. He comes to her apartment, ready to propose, and every time he starts to get the words out, the telephone rings. You know, the telephone in 1947, fairly new invention, but becoming really a part of the fabric of life for a lot of people. And it's this constant stream of interruptions until finally he gives up and leaves. He keeps saying he has to leave on a business trip. So he finally gives up and leaves, walks to the corner and picks up a payphone and calls Lucy and proposes over the telephone. So
that's very cute.
Yeah, it's very cute. It's not terribly deep, although... You know, really, Menotti was very forward-looking, if you think about, and this is true for a lot of his works. You know, we have this problem today. How many times do you go to a restaurant and you see a bunch of young people?
Oh, no, that's totally contemporary.
Yeah, they're totally sitting there looking at their phones. How many times do I tell my 16-year-old, David, put the phone away when we're at the table? You know, it's part of our life today. So it's very relevant even today, but... it is set in the 1950s, though.
Okay.
Okay. And the music is cute. And we talked about how to tie it into the Halloween theme a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't have anything intrinsically Halloweenish about it at all. It's just a little comedy between two people. It's kind of like an older episode of I Love Lucy, frankly.
Mm-hmm. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. But we needed to tie it in somehow. And so very early on I said, they're going to be zombies. And they've actually ended up being Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein. But everybody in the show, we're setting it as if it's a radio show that Monica's listening to. And so everybody from the two lead characters to the stagehand to the producer and the makeup artist, everybody is dressed as some kind of a Halloween monster.
I love it. So Monica from The Medium is listening to this as a radio show?
Yes, awesome. She's listening to the radio. They're listening at the beginning of The Medium when it first opens. They're playing checkers and listening to the radio.
This is
the show that they would be listening to. It's kind of like I Love Lucy meets the Munsters from the old sitcoms, TV sitcoms.
This is great. Well, let's hear some of the music.
Okay.
Now, Lucy, I've something to tell you. I'm going away.
Oh, dear, when are you going?
My train leaves in an hour.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But before I go, I would like to ask you something.
Yes, dear.
You know how much I've always liked you.
Yes, dear.
Well, then, I was just wondering, that is, of course, after I come back, if you would consider...
What, dear?
I don't quite know how to tell you.
Excuse me. Hello, hello. Oh, Marguerite, it's you. I am so glad you called. I was just thinking of you. It's been a long time since you called me. Oh, I cannot come tonight. No, my dear, I'm not feeling very well. When, where, I wish I could be there. I'm afraid I must not.
This while, Ben is sitting on the couch waiting and looking at his watch. Come on, Lucy, wrap it up. And this repeats. She has this whole section where she asks about everybody in Margaret's family.
Right.
And then she talks a little bit more. And then she starts to say goodbye. And Margaret says something else funny. And she goes right back in and asks about everybody Margaret's ever met in her life. How is Sarah? How is Sam? How's the pussycat? How's the dog?
And he's just sitting there.
And he's just sitting there the whole time.
A patient dude.
Yes.
And that he still wants to propose to her after being such a jerk.
Yeah, and this one is all, you know, kind of gossipy and chatty. She gets a wrong number.
Yeah.
He says, well, the time is getting late. And she says, oh, would you like me to call and check on the exact time? And she calls the time service and listens and tells him the time. She gets a phone call from her friend George, who's mad because she's been gossiping about him, and they have a fight over the phone. Then she has to call her friend Pamela and tell her about the fight. And you know, it's just kind of a nonstop onslaught.
I love it. It's that, like, the novelty of the telephone. She's just like totally wrapped up in it.
She is. And at one point she leaves. She's upset by the fight on the phone with George, so she leaves to go get a handkerchief. And Ben sings about how this is such a monster, this telephone. And he sees a pair of scissors lying on a table. And he starts to cut the cord, and she comes in and catches him.
You wicked man! What were you doing to it?
I was only trying.
The poor thing.
And her response is, "Oh, how dare you, the poor thing."
"I assure you it was all in self-defense.
You must have hit it first."
And he says, "Well, it was self-defense." And she says, "Well, you must have hit it first." I mean, she treats this almost like it's her baby, this telephone.
Oh my God. That is hilarious. And there's something kind of endearing about the fact that Menotti placed this very sort of cute, lighthearted, very, like you said, I Love Lucy-esque romantic piece after this very sort of dark.
Well, it's before.
Oh,
it opens
before.
The show. Yeah, it's an opener. It's kind of like an opening act.
So he butters you up.
Uh-huh.
And then he basically ruins you.
Yeah, because after Medium, you're so drained. It's so cathartic.
Okay.
You know, the suspense and the and everything that goes down in it. It's just so cathartic. You couldn't have anything after it.
Wow. Okay.
But they make a very good pair because they're very different and you know, the greatest tragedies always have comic elements.
True. And I think that this also really shows his range as a composer and a librettist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that he's able to kind of, I'm thinking of like contemporary examples. I mean, it's essentially like an episode of Breaking Bad coupled with, you know, Big Bang Theory or something like that.
It is.
And he's able to do both of them
very well. And in fact, the other two works that he's best known for, one is called The Old Maid and the Thief, which is high comedy with some serious themes, but it's very comic. And the other one is his masterpiece, The Consul, which is a very Kafka-esque exploration of this woman who is caught in the system, and it eventually destroys her.
Yikes.
So there is a huge range of possibilities in his work.
What an interesting guy. Well, tell me a little bit more about the Opera in the Heights approach and what makes it unique. You said that there are zombies, which obviously is probably not typically done.
It's not. But that's just for fun. I mean, that's really lighthearted. When you go see La Traviata at Houston Grand Opera, you're miles away and you see a spectacle. When you see it at Opera in the Heights, you're part of it. You're at the party with Violetta. Huh. You're in the room when she's dying. I mean, it so involves the audience and engages them in what's going on. It's not just watching something. And that's perfect for this show. I mean, every night I expect people to say, no, don't shoot. It's him. You know, I mean, I really, people get so involved in it.
Yeah.
And it gives it a really visceral feeling, especially for a show like this. I mean, it's fun when you're doing a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing a show like this that you really want the audience to experience something, to feel something, this is the way to do it.
I love it. Awesome. Well, Linda McKnight, thank you so much for coming on and teaching me about Menotti and about these two operas. It was really fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Okay, everybody, that's about it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Don't forget to rate and review us. Follow us on Twitter and Tumblr and our spiffy YouTube channel. Send me email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks today to audio producer Todd, my telephone Hulslander, for making us sound good. Thanks to program director St. John Flynn for bringing it whatever it is. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing bionic eyes. Thanks to Linda McKnight for being here today and to Opera in the Heights. Thanks to me for saying words, and thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.